This is CD 1 of an 18 CD set containing sessions from a 4-week course by Ram Dass titled The Yogas of the Bhagavad Gita. It was presented at the Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado from June 11th to July 11th, 1974. This CD contains session number 1, the introduction.
This is a course entitled The Yogas of the Bhagavad Gita. It is a course on a Hindu text taught by a Jew in a Buddhist university. Who has a great love for Christ and Allah. This course is primarily concerned with the devotional and karma yogic aspects of life. To me, words are birds. They come and they go, and what I say may not be as important as just the fact that we are together concerned with the Bhagavad Gita. My understanding of what we're doing here is because you are genuinely seeking in the realm of the development of the spirit of your own consciousness. That's what I'm doing here. And when we are gathered together in that way, with trust and with open hearts, a transmission occurs. And that transmission is one which deepens all of our connectedness to the living spirit, to the faith, in the possibility of who we are when we finish being who we thought we were. Now, when I use the word transmission, there is a tendency to think that I am going to transmit something to you, that he will transmit to us. And I would like to read to you a quote from Ramakrishna, which says that rainwater falling upon the roof of a house flows down to the ground, often through spouts shaped grotesquely like a tiger's head. One gets the impression that the water comes from the tiger's mouth, but in reality it descends from the sky. In the same way, the holy teachings that come from the mouths of godly men seem to be uttered by those men themselves, while in reality they proceed from God. In talking with Swami Muktananda, who is a very, very beautiful saint from India, I was expressing to him my feeling of presumption at attempting to teach the Gita. In India, most people are pundits. It's part of the way of life. Most people are great scholars, really, and they have all made extensive studies of the Gita. The Gita is a book which has been commentaried more than any other book in the history of man. And often I've gotten into long philosophical discussions about the Gita with the railway conductor or the sweeper, because in everybody's spare time, or when they're finished with the spare thing of doing their regular work, they're doing the important work, which is studying the Gita or the Ramayana. And so I was telling Swami Muktananda that I thought it was a little presumptuous for me, because I'm not a Sanskrit scholar and I'm really not a great intellect about the Gita either. And he told me this story. Krishna, as you may or may not know, I'll tell you a little bit about Krishna soon, but Krishna, at one stage of his incarnation as an avatar, was this beautiful young blue boy. And there was a great student of the Gita, an old man, and his wife, and he was so intent upon studying the Gita that he had stopped doing all of his work. He wouldn't do anything. And they were going without food. And the wife, his wife, was being very harsh on him, saying, "You have a duty to go out and bring his food for the family, at least one or two meals a day." But he wouldn't listen. He'd just go off into the woods and study the Gita. And she kept pressing him and hounding and hounding and pressing. And she was making his life quite difficult, but he would escape to the woods to study the Gita every day. She's screaming at him as he left. And this one day he went out into the woods and he sat studying the Gita, and he came across a line in the Gita which said, if you offer all of your devotion to me, says Krishna, you need worry about nothing in the world. It'll all be taken care of. And he thought, well, isn't that a peculiar line? I mean, here I'm totally devoted to the Gita, to Krishna, and here's my wife all freaked. Yet it says right here that if I am devoted to the Gita, everything will be taken care of. Why isn't everything being taken care of? Okay. At which point he underlined that sentence because he wasn't sure about it. At that moment, back at his house, there was a knock at the door, and the wife went to the door, and there was a young man standing there with bags of rice and dal, lentils and flour, long supply for many months. And the wife said, what are you doing? What is this? He said, this is for the family of somebody who studies the Gita. And he brought in these big bags of food, and she noticed as he was setting them down that on his chest, his shirt was open, and there was a wound on his chest, and there was blood coming out of the wound. And she said to him, what happened to you? And he said, oh, this was done to me. She said, who did this to you? He said, this was done to me by a man studying the Gita out in the woods. And he said no more, and he left. Husband came back, and he saw all the food, and he asked his wife about it. And she said, but you know, she said this peculiar thing. She said, when I looked at him, there was blood coming out of this wound in his chest. And when we asked him what the wound was about, he said, it was done by a man studying the Gita out in the woods. And at this point, the old man realized what had happened, and he passed out. He fainted. And Swami Muktananda said to me, you see, when the man had underlined, he with doubt, the doubt had been the wound in Krishna. Swami Muktananda said, he said, you see, the Gita isn't a book about Krishna. The Gita is Krishna. Gita is Krishna. And he said, you don't have to worry about teaching the Gita. That's none of your business. The Gita will teach itself. You know, Krishna will do it in spite of you. So I have been taken off the hook by Swami Muktananda. I think the reason that when Marvin Casper asked me if I would teach at a new institute in Boulder, I said I would because I very, very highly honor Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. I think we are very, very fortunate to have such an extraordinarily evolved being in our midst. And I have no ashrams, no students, no trip. I'm a student. And what I've been doing in the past few years is feeling that it was my dharma, and we'll be discussing that term ad nauseum. It is my dharma to support pure transmissions in America. Seems to be what my work is. So I've been doing benefits for Zen monasteries, for Hindu yogic ashrams, for Christian Benedictine monasteries, helping the Sufis, making announcements for the Hasids. Because it seems to me that rather than everybody necessarily coming together in big holy man jams to become all one right away, it would be best for us to honor the purity of these transmissions and let the amalgam or the bubbling together or the soup be cooked inside each pilgrim, each one of us, rather than having the outer thing become all one a little too soon. I think the horror show about tradition that we are all coming out from under is likely the thing that happened in India at great length, at great extent, which was the attachment to the rituals and the ceremonies as ends in themselves in a mechanical, ritualistic priestcraft way, with the living spirit gone from them. And that's roughly what happened to the Christian church as opposed to the living Christ. And I think that one of our processes now is to be sophisticated enough not to thoroughly throw out the baby with the bath. See, a lot of us have come through throwing over one tradition after another. We've thrown over sexual traditions in this culture. We've thrown over economic and working conditions. We've thrown over social relations, marriage, communal family, all kinds of political ones. And in most cases, that's come out of, in large part, a healthy awakening to the deadness of existing structures. In other cases, it's come out of our own rebelliousness. But somehow, we've gotten a little bit lost in thinking traditions per se are bad. One of the things that has turned me on a lot is I've gone to a lot of traditional religious ceremonies in both the East and the West. And you go into a church, and what you often see is everybody going through this ritual as if they were doing their shopping list at the supermarket. They're singing songs about Christ on the cross, you know, but nothing's happening. And I listen to the words of the songs, and I look at the ceremony and the ritual, and it's all came out of the living spirit originally, but it got lost in the shuffle, and now it's just this mechanical stuff. But as I come back to it with eyes that are tuned to other planes of consciousness, and when I center enough and don't get lost in the reactiveness to the situation of, oh, this is a drag, you know, suddenly, there it all is, the living spirit again. And I think that what a gathering of this nature is about is partly we are all being prepared. We are all being prepared to serve in the capacity of reinvesting a society with the living spirit. And that comes through our becoming it, because the only thing you transmit from one human being to another is your being. All the fancy words aren't going to mean a damn thing. Now, why, when he said, what would you like to teach? I said, the yoga of the Bhagavad Gita, or the yogas of the Bhagavad Gita. Well, the first reason, I think, and the most profound reason, is because of my guru. If there are two books which most characterize the quality of the transmission that I received from Maharaji, from my guru, who has now left his body, those two books are the Ramayana, Tulsidas's Ramayana, and the Bhagavad Gita. Part of my way of sharing with other people the grace of whatever happened to me in relation to this being in India is by using vehicles like the Gita and the Ramayana. Because although Maharaji never talked to me specifically, or maybe once or twice, about the Gita, when I study the Gita and look at the things he said to me, they always turn out to be the same stuff. So I can feel the parallels there. And the other part of teaching the Gita is the honoring of a tradition. That I come out of the West as an intellectual, social, political Jew, and I go to India, and through a tradition, taken into a temple, and through puja and kirtan and mantra and Guru Kripa and the satsang, I am opened to a great extent through this vehicle of this tradition. That opening in that tradition opens me in a way where then the next thing I start to study is the New Testament, which I never read, being a good Jew. And as I read the New Testament, I suddenly meet the living Christ. And now slowly, you always come back to the original place last, perhaps, I'm beginning to get the joy and beauty out of the, say, the Hasid tradition, Judaism. There are a number of stages in the evolution of consciousness, a number of stages in the awakening process. Some of these stages are characterized in the Gita as you trace Arjuna's awakening through the 18 chapters. First there's despair, and then there's a possibility, and then there's a beginning of awakening, and then comes chapters 7 through 12, which are primarily the opening of the mystic vision and the deepening of the direct experience, and then comes the last part, which is when the faith is strong and the laying on of the heavy wisdom. That's the way that's spelled out in the Gita. We are representing in this group of people a variety of levels of consciousness, who you and I are. Some of us are just beginning to feel a little bit of malaise, a little bit of discomfort with the way the game's been going in life. And in the other end, some of you are so drunk with bliss of mystic vision that it's everything you can do to stay here and not go off into a cave. And people have to force you to eat because all worldly desire has fallen away. Some of you laugh cynically, some of you laugh knowingly, see? That's differences in the stage. I'm going to read you a series of quotations about stages so you can get a feeling of what the range of the dance is. This is Jacob Bohm, the Christian mystic. The external world or the external life is not a valley of suffering for those who enjoy it, but only for those who know of a higher life. The animal enjoys animal life. The intellect, the intellectual realm. But he who has entered into regeneration recognizes his terrestrial existence as a burden and a prison. With this recognition, he takes upon himself the cross of Christ. Now, you can say, well, it's not all burden and prison. And when you, whatever you answer to that, you're answering from where you are sitting. So if you don't judge, just listen and hear these all as a kind of a cut-up of stages. Matthew 13, for this people's heart is waxed gross, and their ears are dull of hearing, and their eyes they have closed. But blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. For verily I say unto you, that many prophets and righteous men have desired to see those things which you see and have not seen them, and to hear those things which you hear and have not heard them. Uspensky, a student of Gurdjieff, but I had an inner conviction that something had already changed in me and that now everything would go differently. Recognize that one? This is a nice one about Gurdjieff and Uspensky. Our friends found us becoming dull. Gurdjieff said, there is worse to come. He is an interesting man who lies well. You've already begun to die. It is a long way yet to complete death, but still a certain amount of silliness is going out of you. You can no longer deceive yourselves as sincerely as you did before. You have now got the taste of truth. That one we recognize. The line, you can no longer deceive yourself as sincerely as you did before. That word sincerely is just so essence. It's just how sincere we've been in our deception, in our self-righteousness. Ramakrishna, the nearer you come to God, the less are you disposed to question and reason. When you come up to him, when you behold him as the reality, then all noise, all disputations are at an end. Then it's time for sleep, for the enjoyment which comes in samadhi, in which one is in a state of communion with the blessed vision divine. A Zen statement. When an ordinary man attains knowledge, he is a sage. When a sage attains understanding, he is an ordinary man. So that when we finish this entire journey, we will then fully be the statement of nothing special. It's very reassuring, isn't it? Kabir. Dancing is not for me anymore. The mind no longer plays the tune. What was empty is now full. The vessel of desires is broken. The gown of desire has become frayed. All illusions are gone. Parts enough have I played. I can act no more. Friends and companions have all forsaken me. The restless ones are steady at last. All disputes are settled. Kabir says, by Ram's grace, he has found his full reward. Thomas Merton. As soon as a man is fully disposed to be alone with God, he is alone with God no matter where he may be. In the country, the monastery, the woods, or the city. The lightning flashes from east to west, illuminating the whole horizon and striking where it pleases. And at the same instant, the infinite liberty of God flashes in the depths of that man's soul, and he is illumined. At that moment, he sees that though he seems to be in the middle of his journey, he has already arrived at the end. For the life of grace on earth is the beginning of the life of glory. Although he is a traveler in time, he has opened his eyes for a moment in eternity. And though some of that may be said in a way that's difficult for us to hear just yet, for example, the life of grace on earth is the beginning of the life of glory. May I say that perhaps by the end of the course, if not now, you will recognize that you are primarily no longer existing with your basic identification on the plane of reality that you started out with, that you are already a novice or a participant in another realm or loka or plane of consciousness that becomes more real than the one you left behind. It, of course, will turn out to be an illusion too, but that will come in due time. And these are some instructions to you from Chuang Tzu about this course. Pass directly. Don't listen with your ears. Listen with your mind. No. Don't listen with your mind. Listen with your spirit. Listening stops with the ears. The mind stops with recognition. But the spirit is empty and waits on all things. And the way gathers in emptiness alone. Emptiness is the fasting of the mind. It's easy to keep from walking. The hard thing is to walk without touching the ground. You see, part of our head trips about courses is we go back into a certain perceptual frame of reference about stuff. And who are we again? We are the researcher. We're the judger, collector, observer, analyzer, using our analytic mind and identifying with it. There is another way of doing this whole trip, and that is by being so empty, by being so non-judgmental. I mean, if you're taking 3 or 4 courses, you will go insane if you try to analytically bring it all together, because there is an incredible amount of paradox in the situation. And the rational mind will be boggled, I assure you. Now, I have no trouble whatsoever loving Trungpa taking teachings from him, loving Maharaji taking teachings, going to a Christian monastery taking teachings, sitting in Zen Buddhism and taking teachings and solving koans. To me, it all comes together, but I wouldn't try to analytically tell how it comes together. It comes together because I decided at one stage of the game to open Pandora's box and let it all in. And whatever would float, would float. I even remember when it happened. It was back at Harvard, and Tim Leary and I were doing research on psychedelics at Harvard. And Harvard was getting a little concerned because we had just ordered $500,000 of LSD from Switzerland. And they set up a watchdog committee, which was unheard of for faculty members to watch over each other. But it was getting pretty desperate. And I was on that committee with other men, and we couldn't agree on anything. And so finally, some of the faculty had a public meeting in order to put down our work. And the thrust of the meeting was that we were not scientific, mainly because we were ingesting these chemicals ourselves. And how could you be a scientist when you were changing your perceptual viewpoint in the midst of your observing study? Now, there is a very rich tradition in psychology called introspectionism, but that's in very low repute because of the takeover of behaviorism. And in behaviorism, everything must be publicly reproduced. It bought physics as a model for human study, and therefore rejected all inner experience other than what could be said outwardly and written down and then studied as the written material, not as what would happen inside. And Timothy took the stand, "I am a scientist, you people don't understand what science is." And Timothy happens to be a damn good philosopher of science, and I think he had a very good argument. And he protested that they were persecuting science because of their own position. I was experiencing being caught in the middle of the situation that the most powerful things that had ever happened to me were happening to me through every Saturday night. And that somehow that was more real to me than what I was doing teaching Freudian psychodynamics on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And I was not sure that I could bring the stuff together at that point. And I took the stance quite different from Timothy. I said, "You're absolutely right, gentlemen and ladies. I am no longer a scientist." Turning in my badge. From now on, I should be considered a datum. I'm data, right? And you may study me to see what happened to him who did that in the 60s, right? Too bad about poor Dick, that one, right? And you can study, and you can be the scientist. You can have the role. I give it up. "He dwells for innumerable years in the heaven of those who did good. And then this man who failed in yoga is born again in the house of the good and the great. He may even be born into a family of yogis, where the wisdom of yoga shines. But to be born into such a family is a rare event in this world." Now, if you can begin to reflect on your own life, as I do, as a continuing part of an unfolding drama, and that which family you took birth in, who your father turns out to be, who your mother turns out to be, who your brothers and sisters turn out to be, what experiences you have had thus far in your life, are all part of a predetermined karmic package. And that all this is running off perfectly lawfully. There is no chance in this system. The laws of reincarnation, the laws of karma, are unbending. And there is no force in the universe that is aside from them. You say, well, isn't God aside from the laws of karma? Well, God, in a way, is the laws of karma. And there is a question of why someone would break their own law, though they have the capacity to destroy the whole thing with a thought, why he or she or it would do it. Now, all this that is talking about reincarnation sounds awfully solid, like you are somebody who is passing through birth and death and birth and death and birth and death. And who is that somebody? Who is that somebody? And to bring it together for you a little bit with other systems, let me quote again from the Pali literature. There are no real ego entities hastening through the ocean of rebirth, but merely life waves, which according to their nature and activities, manifest themselves here as men, there as animals, and elsewhere as invisible things. Every act you create, every act you do, depending on the desire connected with that act, which we're going to be talking about, creates in your mind what in Hinduism are called vasanas, or subtle thought forms, thought waves. And they remain. And when you die, they remain. Because what dies is the physical body, and there are sheaths, and these sheaths go. And what are remaining are these subtle mental tendencies, which function like a DNA code, which determine the next round, if you will. And as you meditate more deeply, you will begin to see your own mind coming into existence, existing, and dying, coming into existence, existing, and dying, coming into existence, existing, and dying. But over that continuity, you will see incredible repetitiveness of the nature of the content of those thought forms. It's interesting, the question is, if you create karma now and then you're born again, are you the same person that's reaping the karma who sowed it? And it's much like if you take a candle and light another candle, is it the same flame? Or is there merely a transmission from one to another to another to another, and really the person who's reaping the karma, like you are reaping the karma of incredible past lifetimes. At one point in the Pali literature, the bhikkhus asked the Buddha, why did so-and-so, this very, very high being, why did he die such a horrible death? I mean, it isn't fair. He's been so pure, he's been so good, he's been such a high bhikkhu. Why should he die such a horrible death? And Buddha says, well, I'll tell you how it is. Some 500 births ago, he killed his parents. And he's been paying for it every birth since then. Now, I can experience in my own life that when I go to India and go into these villages and I find myself doing sadhana and sitting in a very simple environment and realize that I came out of a Jewish middle-class Boston environment where 12 years ago I didn't even know the word yoga. And if anybody had said, you know, 12 years from now, you'll be a yogi. I mean, when I was on the Harvard faculty, I would have laughed. See? Because it's a drag. See? Because if I take that role, I've got to sit, and everything that comes near me, I've got to say, well, will I accept it? What is the probability of its reoccurrence? See? How many sigma, you know? And I've got to live in a probabilistic model and sit with the skeptical stance of doubt, which always keeps me a certain distance from the here, because I always have to be one thought away. And I realized I didn't want to be one thought away from life anymore. I wanted to dive into the soup and the hell with it, and whatever would happen, would happen. I wanted to get to the point where when I sit in India in a village and people tell me stories about miracles that would turn the hair of Westerners gray, I'd say, yeah, of course, far out. And I can mean it. As far as I'm concerned, it's all true. Right? And if it isn't, that's its problem, not mine. Okay? Right? Now, this puts some burden on you. Because I'm not going to represent your superego. I'm not going to sit and be critical. I'm just going to be data, right? And therefore, you have the choice of which stance you will take. Are you going to say, ah, the hell with it, let's go? Or are you going to say, well, I'll watch and keep an open mind? It was like, well, to show how many incarnations you can cram into one lifetime. Let me say that at Harvard, I was a member of a junta, a group of young Turks in the social relations department who were trying to toughen up the department by more statistics requirements and experimental methodology. Right? And at that time, when parapsychological phenomena occurred, I would say, very interesting. We certainly must keep an open mind. Okay, that was my professional position. Then I started to take psychedelics, and all these things started to happen to me. And I said, I have ingested a psychotropic agent, and I am having a hallucination, and it's fascinating. Okay. And then a lot like what Carl Jung does in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, I said, fortunately, I can come back to my family and my home and to reality. See? That was another stage. Then as time went on, it became less and less clear which one I was coming back to. And then as I stopped worrying about that, which made you very edgy in terms of mental health, phenomena started to occur to me when I was not under a psychedelic, so I had no recourse to the fact that it hadn't happened to me, it had happened to somebody else, so I couldn't use the scientific one of very interesting, we must keep an open mind, because it just happened to me, nor could I say, well, it was a psychotropic ingestion, this is a hallucination. So I was left without a defense. And there is a predicament about blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear, that there are phenomena, which we will be reflecting upon in this course, that are available to her or to him who has not veiled herself or himself from them through attachment to your own thought. All of it is available to everybody. But it depends on who you think you are as to whether or not it is available to you. And that's why the stance you take in the way you are responding to education has a lot to do with whether or not you can totally grok Tibetan Buddhism, whether you can grok the Gita. Those of you that aren't familiar with that term, it's from Robert Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land, and it means become one with, be consumed into. Grok means that if we ground one of us up in a stew and the other one ate it, we would grok one another and it wouldn't matter who did the eating. Okay, that's Heinlein's definition of grok. They kept translating what they heard into their habitual language. They had ceased to hope and believe there might be anything new. Now, in designing the program for Naropa, my one request was that meditation be an integral part of the Institute, because it seemed to me that what we bring to a new environment are our predisposing set of thought forms, and that they filter everything so that nothing new ever happens. Have you noticed that? Like you come and you say, it's all going to be new in Boulder, and then later on you say, gee, you know, Boulder was just like San Francisco. I mean, you've been through enough of these by now. I know that I've thought I'm neurotic in New York, I'll go to Chicago, and I end up being just as neurotic in Chicago. Okay? Because you keep recreating your own hells, or heavens, whichever one you're attached to. And when you create this universe, you're creating it because your mind, you know, you walk into the to a new situation, and immediately you label it in terms of your own attachments, and that's what we're going to talk lots about in this course. First of all, I am going to assume that everybody has read the Bhagavad Gita. It'll only take you about 3 or 4 hours to read anyway. May I suggest you read it the first time as a very interesting story? May I next suggest that you read the Gita twice more. The first time, after we have finished our discussion of the basic conflict that Arjuna finds himself in, and you have personalized that sufficiently to understand what the predicament is, that you read it identifying with Arjuna. That is, you read it as if you are... That is, once you have realized what your own conflict is that gets you to itch enough to want to scratch to come to Boulder, right? Use that as the framework from which to read the thing and hear Krishna telling you how it is about your own battleground. And when you are ready, may I suggest a third reading of the Gita in which you read it identifying with Krishna. Because that, in fact, is who you truly are. Now, that will raise some interesting problems for you, because many of us have a difficult time thinking of ourselves as God. But don't let that upset you, because we have an exercise called contemplation, which suggests a way of approaching the study of the Gita, especially when you're doing this third reading where you're identifying with Krishna. Because you will read a line and you'll say to yourself, I never would have said that. See? But in fact, Krishna did say that. And we are opening ourselves to this book. So then you will sit down and you will take the line that you don't understand and you will take the way you think it ought to be and you will just sit with those two things. And you will sit with them. And you will sit with them. And you'll let your mind wander around it and you'll come back to it. And you'll take the Gita shloka by shloka, not every one of them. Sometimes you read a whole page and it'll be, oh, yeah, sure, right on, I agree with that. And then you'll come to a line and say, what? You know, like, I never would have said that. That's the one, see? Just sit with it. Who's the I that would never have said that? See? Because these lines will show you where you're holding, where your stash is. See? This will show you where you, okay? Right? You may end up underlying the Gita and stabbing Krishna in the heart. That's up to you. That's your problem, not mine, all right? But in the meantime, you will have the opportunity to work with this shloka by shloka as a contemplation exercise and different things you can do as contemplation and stuff like that. And now, those of you that want to leave, leave, and those of you that would like to sing are more than welcome to sing.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ram Hare Ram 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 Hare 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 Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ram Hare Ram 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 Hare 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 Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ram Hare Ram 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 Hare 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 Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ram Hare Ram 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 Hare 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 Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ram Hare Ram 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 Hare 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 Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Ram Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna Hare Hare,